Hi there, this is Rocky, and it's been my pleasure to host a Server's Journey podcast over the past 3 years. Recently, Larry and I have taken a short hiatus to reimagine what the future holds for this podcast. So we ask that you join us in the fall as we start a new season with fresh content. In the meantime, we reviewed some of the past episodes, and we found a few that we think you might be needing to hear. As always, we thank you for listening so regularly, and we need you now more than ever. So we ask that you please reach out on our social media, let us know the things you want us to talk about, and as always, like us, subscribe, leave us reviews, and share with your friends. So Larry, crank up this episode and let us know how it affected your journey of serving.
Yeah, Mark Miller began his career with Chick-fil-A, working as an hourly team member in 1977.
And oh, that was kind of like what you did, didn't it?
Yeah, a little bit later. You know, don't age me, but you know, as I was mentioning before, Mark joined the corporate staff for Chick-fil-A in 1978, and in over 30 years with Chick-fil-A, he has served in numerous leadership capacities, including restaurant operations, quality and customer satisfaction, and corporate communications. And during this time, he has seen Chick-fil-A grow from a small company to annual sales of over $9 billion, and the company expanding to more than 2,300 restaurants in almost every state in the U.S.
And, you know, Mark is a best-selling author. He's written books like Leaders Are Made Here, Building a Leadership Culture, The Secret of Teams. He's also co-authored with Ken Blanchard, and his latest book is called Talent Magnet, which is a book I really have enjoyed.
Mark, let's start with your story. I kind of mentioned that you started with Chick-fil-A in 1977. To talk about your story and how you got here.
Well, I started in a restaurant as an hourly team member. I worked for Bubba Caffey, Truett Caffey's youngest son. He was my operator. And we both realized very, very quickly that I was not cut out for the restaurant business. And I was just awful. As I talked to other business leaders, I asked them to think about the worst employee they ever hired. That was me. And thankfully, I escaped after about 6 months without Bubba firing me, which I thought was quite an accomplishment. And I made my way to the home office, which made perfect sense to me as a kid, right? I wasn't good in the restaurant, but maybe I could work at the home office. And so I walked in and told the receptionist that I wanted a job in the warehouse. And just a moment later, Truett Caffey came out, took me into his office to conduct the interview. And people have often thought that odd, and I share with them the rest of the story. I was interviewing to be the 16th corporate employee.
Oh, wow.
And when you only have 15 employees, it makes a little more sense that the head man is actually doing the interviews. And Truett, after just a few questions, told me I could have the job working in his warehouse and got to also work in the mailroom. I didn't know that it was a twofer. And so that started my career, and that was 40 years ago this year.
That does not seem possible.
It's been quite a journey since then.
Now, how big was that warehouse then?
Well, it's interesting you ask that question, because there were four of us working in the warehouse out of 16 people.
Wow.
So it was a big part of the organization. But what we did back then is the warehouse had two primary functions. One is we shipped the trucks to open every new location. So we packaged up a truck with everything they would need, down to the small wares and the pots and the pans and the paper towel dispensers. So we would pack those trucks, and then we would send operators parts that we stocked, so that when various pieces of equipment would go down, they could count on us to get them something in a timely fashion. And so it was a significant part of the corporate staff as far as headcount, even back in the day.
Mark, how many stores were there with Chick-fil-A when you joined?
I think there were about 75.
Oh, wow. So, yeah.
Wow, I didn't realize there were that many then.
Yeah.
Yes.
We kind of spoke about, so you really have seen it from 75 to well over 2,000 stores now, and $9 billion in sales, which is a staggering number when I think about it.
Yeah, it's been a great adventure. And I've had the privilege to work all across the business. a friend of mine here at the Chick-fil-A introduced me at an event recently, and he said, "I'm a guy who can't hold down a job." I said, "Well, that's one way to look at it." But I have just been so thankful for the opportunity to work in really 6 or 8 or 10 different roles over 40 years.
Yeah, you know, Mark, we're going to get to your books too here, because I think that's where you just had tremendous impact in my life for sure. And before we kind of get to your books, I'm kind of interested if you could to answer maybe this question about what do you see the difference between a good book and a great book? What do you look for as you're writing?
Well, here's I guess my cut on that. All good books have something in common.
Okay.
Good content.
Yeah, for sure.
But a great book is differentiated by the timing in which you interact with that content.
Okay.
I could read a book today that's good, and that content will be good indefinitely, assuming it's not a trendy topic or something. But I might read that book 5 years from now, or have read it 5 years ago, when that timing in my life and my circumstances elevated that good content to great content.
Wow, that's a great way of looking at it for sure. And I think sometimes it depends what you're going through at the moment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think it always depends on that. I mean, I think we run everything we read and hear and are exposed to through our current circumstances. And if I'm struggling raising a teenager, a book on that topic makes a lot more sense than to read it when that child was 3 or when that child is 30.
Sure. Yeah.
Same is true with leadership books. If you're having trouble with employee engagement, that's when that good book can become a great book.
So let me ask you a question. Is there a great author or a great book that you have read or that you like that just doesn't get the credit they deserve?
Well, that's another wonderful question. As far as authors go, I think Henry Cloud, now although he's very famous and he sold millions of books, I don't think he gets the credit in business circles.
Yeah,
because
I agree.
He has done so many faith-based books. I just don't think he gets the street cred among business leaders and CEOs. But his book, Necessary Endings, is one of the best books I have ever read.
Yeah, me too.
For business leaders.
Yeah, I tell you what, that book has guided me through some really tough decisions. I tend to be a heart person, so, you know, I value results, but I value relationships. And if I'm not cautious, I overvalue those sometimes. And that book has greatly helped me.
Yeah, and I don't know if you remember where you got that book, and I don't know for sure, but I sent a copy to every operator about 5 years ago. I just bought a couple thousand of them and sent them out.
I'm pretty sure that's where I got it.
Yeah, because I said this. So that's just one example. Henry has done several other books that are really, really, really good for business leaders, and I don't think he gets enough street cred with business leaders.
Yeah.
A specific book, I think, was the other part of your question, a book I stumbled upon a couple of years ago that I had never heard of, and I've not heard anyone really talking about it, but I've been giving it out. It's called Insanely Simple by Ken Segal. And here's the quick overview on that. He did an insider's look at Apple's success.
Oh, wow.
He was on Steve's team for about 10 years. And here's the premise of the book as I interpret it. People think Steve Jobs was Apple's secret sauce. He says that is not correct. He said Steve Jobs' maniacal focus on simplicity was what made Apple great.
Wow.
It is a fascinating book, and I've given lots of copies. So I think that book doesn't get the credit it's due. It's been out. It's a 6-year-old book. I just discovered it about 18 months ago.
Wow, that's great.
Insanely Simple.
Insanely Simple. Powerful, powerful book.
Okay.
So Mark, you've been you really are. You're mentioning other authors, but you're a best-selling author here in your own right, and you've had books like Leaders Made Here, Beating a Building a Leadership Culture, my probably personal favorite, although I don't know if I can pick one, but Chestnut Checkers really spoke to me, and I think it was maybe what I was going through. You know, you've written The Secret of Teams, you know, The Heart of Leadership, and then your most recent book, The Talent Magnet. And I'm wondering, how did you get started writing about leadership?
Well, I'm the accidental author is the full truth. Don't tell anybody I said that, but that's exactly the best way to label me. I never had any desire or aspirations to write books. And almost 20 years ago, we were working on how to accelerate leadership development at Chick-fil-A. We just saw that need in our corporate staff. We could see it on the horizon as the restaurants were growing in volume and complexity. We felt like operators were going to need to accelerate leadership development. And so I was asked to lead a team to work on that. And I'll spare you those details, but as we neared the end of that work, we had created what we now call our SERVE model.
Yeah.
And we actually had a crisis of confidence. I don't know any other way to describe it, because we sell chicken, right? I mean, this was not our area of expertise, but I will say the team was fantastic and had worked diligently for a couple of years. I mean, you look at the SERVE model and think it's really pretty simple. Well, we think there's often something simple on the other side of complexity. We walked through 2 years of complexity to try and figure out what is the essence of our belief about leadership. And so we got to that point, and we had this crisis of confidence, and we said, what if this is not right? I mean, that's actually the question we were wrestling with as a team. And either coincidence or divine appointment, you can decide. I was going to be with Ken Blanchard the next day, and I said, well, why don't we get some other people who know a lot more about leadership than we do to weigh in and tell us what they think? And so I told them I was going to be with Ken the next day, and they said, wow, that'd be great. And so I showed Ken the SERVE model, and I said, Ken, we've been trying to accelerate leadership development. I need you to look at this. Tell me, do you think it's true? Do you think it's valid? Do you think it'll stand the test of time? You know, did we miss anything? And the first thing out of his mouth was, this has to be a book.
Oh, wow.
First thing he said, and I blew him off. And I said, Ken, everything looks like a book to you. I mean, he's a friend of mine. I can say those kind of things, right? I said, everything looks like a book to you, which, by the way, is why he sold about 70 million books.
Yeah, that's a pretty staggering number.
I said, we don't want to write a book. We just want to accelerate leadership development. And he said, you don't understand. And I said, okay, what do I not understand? I mean, there's a lot I don't understand, but, you know, what are you referring to specifically? He said, you guys were trying to articulate what great leaders do at Chick-fil-A. He said, what you have done is you have articulated what great leaders have done throughout history.
Wow.
And it has to be a book. Wow. And so he persisted, and that's how I became an author. And so that was my first rodeo, so to speak. And he was a tremendous co-author, partner, and mentor, and kind of established the pattern that I have used for all of my books. And that was a direct reflection of working with him.
So talk about, what is your writing process like? Because I love writing, and I'm really good for about a couple thousand words, and then I kind of peter out. How do you write? I mean, how do you, and especially how do you write this much and still be relevant?
Well, that is the goal, is to remain relevant. I think my process, and I'm not assuming that this would even work for anyone else, and I don't know if some of your listeners might not have read my books. I don't write real books, so I think you got to start there. These are stories, and I tell people I don't know that I've got the skill nor the temperament to write a real book, but I can tell a story.
Right.
So I think I've got a head start by saying all we're trying to do when I'm writing a book is I'm trying to discover or to discern what is true. That is step one. Because if it's not true, it's not going to resonate. It's not going to add value. It's not going to connect. It's not going to stand the test of time. So every one of my projects begins with a search for truth.
Wow. Yeah. You know,
so that's where we start.
And I feel though, I mean, you're underestimating yourself. I think it's the story that type. It's what makes it so approachable for so many people. You know, I have a wide array of people from age 16, sometimes even a 15-year-old thrown in there, all the way to 50-year-old. And what I love about your books is that they're so approachable to anybody, that they're not intimidating, but yet there's at the core that truth that you're talking about?
Well, thank you for that, because that is, you ask about my process. It begins with that search for truth, and then I'm trying to find a way to make the truth approachable and applicable.
Okay.
So that's my deal. I mean, I've been told I'm painfully pragmatic, and the person who said that, I don't think they meant it as a compliment, and I said, thank you. I said, because it, I think there's so much truth that is irrelevant, not because it's not true, but because it's not acted upon.
Right.
So if I can find what's true, make it approachable, and make it actionable, that's the perfect storm for me, if I can pull those things together.
Well, I think you have, for sure.
Well, so, thanks.
So in this recent book, and I guess it's Talent Magnet, it's not The Talent Magnet, let me get that right. It seems to be, you know, I know you did a lot of research before you wrote this book. Can you talk about the interviews you did, how many, and who did you ask,
sure,
and so forth?
Sure. Well, let me just back up half a step and say all of the books have been researched, but some of them have been qualitative, some quantitative, and some both. This was both. This was the most researched project we've ever done. And the story behind that is when our operators came to us and said their number one issue was finding and keeping people, that got our attention.
Right.
Because we've been tracking operator issues, I guess, for 30 plus years. And it had always been in the top 10, but usually it hovered between 5 and 7. And as what you well know, Rocky, part of this is our business model.
Sure.
And that the most operators have 75% of their team are teenagers. And
yeah,
so there's some turnover that's built into the system. And so it's an ever-present but historically not urgent issue. Well, it showed up as the number one issue for the first time in history.
Wow.
And that got our attention.
Now, do you see, is that prevalent in all industry or just in the fast food industry?
Well, the war for talent is kind of the popular term that has been buzzing around for close to 20 years. And in some segments, there's been a war for talent for 2 decades.
Right.
For any number of reasons, we had boycotted that by and large. I mean, there's certain operators in certain locations that have always had a unique challenge. But as a chain, we hadn't felt that. And any number of factors, demographic, economic, even down to the unemployment statistics, on and on and on, have moved the battlefront to our doorstep. And so the operators were feeling it. And I got a call from Tim Tosopoulos, who's now our president, head of operations, and it was funny. I knew it was important because we were trying to find a time to meet, and we were looking at our calendar, and it was going to take several weeks to get together. And they said, okay, we're going to be on an offsite together next week, let's meet at 10:30 at night. And I'm
wow.
going, okay, this
yeah.
is important enough that they're saying no, we're going to get this done. And the topic of that meeting was, how can we better help our operators with this issue, understanding that they're independent business people, and leadership and management practices are at the sole discretion of an independent operator. But we said, how might we serve them? And Tim and Cliff acknowledged that some of the resources that we had produced in the past had in fact served the operators. And so they said, why don't you go to work and see what you can come up with? And leading to your question about the research, I naively thought that I would just go buy some research and then
yeah, right.
again, because I'm always looking for truth, and I
right.
still have to go through the process of making it approachable and making it applicable. And what I discovered, and this still boggles my mind every time I have to tell you what I'm about to tell you, we could not find any research in the history of the world on what attracts top talent.
That's amazing to me still.
Still amazing to me. I can't actually believe it. I'm assuming people have done it and they just don't want to confess. But we couldn't find it. We certainly couldn't buy it. So we commissioned what we believe to be the first ever study of what attracts top talent. And in the process, we wanted to do both quantitative and qualitative. And so without getting too deep here, we did a national survey, all 50 states, age 14 to 65, and all the the diverse demographics that you would expect to be sure that we had a really legit sample, thousands of people in that. We also got into some organizations that led us into their performance management system, so we could actually survey their staff, and we segmented and surveyed their top performers and those secondary or B player, you know, typical talent, as we call it in the book, so that we could look for differences in their criteria for choosing that organization. And then on top of that, we did about 450 interviews. Wow. So the biggest research project we've ever encountered, spent a couple of years trying to figure out what is true so that I could continue my process.
Wow, that's
that was a lot.
Yeah.
It was a lot.
So talk about some of the things that you found that were true. I mean, some of the things that you write in the book. I know you mentioned some about, you know, one thing is that it's important that HR know your story. So, you know, talk about some of the things that you found that tended to be truth.
Okay. Well, I'll come back around to the HR part, because that is one of the things we found. But there are a couple of prerequisites that I think are priority that lead to that conclusion. We figured out that top talent's looking for three things. I'll hit this for you really quick, and then if you want to probe, we certainly can go there. They want a better boss.
Okay.
Now, when I share that with people, they're kind of going, well, doesn't everybody want a better boss? Well, yes and no. Everybody would tell you they do, but for top talent, it's a condition of employment.
Wow. Yeah,
see,
that's a strong
typical
statement.
Talent, they'd like to have a better boss, but if they got a lousy one, they'll keep working for you. They'll just talk bad about you in the hall and at dinner when they're family and all that kind of stuff. But top talent, they won't stay.
Yeah. You know, we did a previous episode, and we actually did a show about how top talent, they don't quit organizations, they quit their boss. So
right.
I think you're right. I think for the top talent, that is imperative. It's a must-have.
Yep. And I would just put an asterisk on that. It's just not the senior leader. It's leaders within the organization. And often those feelings and attributes are personalized in their immediate supervisor.
Yeah. Yep.
And so it's not sufficient, Rocky, for you to be a great leader if you've got a crappy leadership team and awful frontline supervisors. Your top talent, they're not going to overlook all that and say, well, Rocky's a good guy.
Yeah, and you know, I'm finding that more and more as my organization grows and as my sales continue to increase, and my leadership team, it's around 29 people if I really count everybody that we would put as leaders. It's even more important that their direct leader is that better boss.
Mm-hmm.
They actually will cut me a little bit of slack because they don't deal with me directly every single moment. But it's really that boss that they would consider to be their boss. So, yeah,
yep.
You're right, for sure.
Yep. So they want a better boss. They also, the second thing they want a brighter future.
Okay.
They want a brighter future. Now, again, you might say, well, doesn't everybody want a brighter future? Well, that's another tricky question, because here's what we discovered. Typical talent, not that they would turn you down, right, if you offer them a brighter future, but typical talent doesn't think as much about the future. That's one of the differentiators. Top talent has a much greater future orientation.
Right.
So they walk into the interview, forget the job. I mean, before the job, they're walking into the interview with a different set of questions. They're asking, how will I grow? What will I learn? How will I be challenged? How will I be stretched? How will this job or this role make me more employable in the future? Typical talent's not asking those questions.
Yep. You're 100% correct on that. And not only what we find is you can keep people longer as long as you consistently help them grow. So they'll kind of stick around for another year or so if they feel like, well, I learned this, but now I can learn this. And I do think it's part of it, especially with the age group that we employ, that they're looking for, this will make me a much more attractive person throughout my career.
Right. And that's why when we talk about this whole idea of talent magnet, it's about attracting and keeping. Because if you do these things, there's also a retention effect. But as you just said, if you don't deliver, let's say even if you make the promise and they come on board and find it's not true, they'll leave.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, I think that. Yeah, no, you're right for sure.
Yeah. So they want a better boss, they want a brighter future, and they want a bigger vision. Bigger vision, they want an organization that's trying to make a difference. They want to make a difference, and they see this as an extension in some ways of themselves. They're looking for an organization and even a brand that they can have some personal resonance with. It's just fascinating, and I think that's a close connection to that future orientation.
Okay.
Right, that's why they're thinking about impact. That's why they're thinking about more than the job itself.
Hmm.
And so those are the three things that the research indicates top talent is looking for.
So, you know, we've heard over and over about this idea of the war on talent. And I've always kind of found it interesting because I think, you know, we're really finding that we've never graduated more graduates than we're doing right now. So I feel like there's all these people that are coming into the workforce, but a lot of industries, a lot of companies would say we're in a desperate war for talent. And, you know, I guess this book is saying that, well, you haven't figured out one of these three yet. Is that a fair comment?
Well, actually, there's a fourth, and you referenced it earlier. You asked about HR knowing your story. Here's what we learned. Those three findings I just shared, I would call the direct findings.
Okay.
That's what the research says. What we discovered, and I'm calling this an indirect finding, but I believe it's just as important as the other three. And we learned this really by talking to business leaders about those three. And I even had some Chick-fil-A operators challenge me and say, I think you missed it. And I'm going, well, I appreciate your perspective. You know, help me understand that. Because we got all this research. We wrote these big checks. We spent all this time. I mean, I'm not saying we couldn't miss it, but tell me why you think we missed it. And I had multiple leaders say, I am doing those three things, and I still can't attract great talent.
Hmm.
And what we discovered, this fourth finding, is that awareness is a significant part of the solution.
Wow.
If you do those things and people don't know, you get no credit.
Hmm.
And so even as I've shared that with business leaders, I've had some leaders point blank say, I do tell the story. I said, okay, what does that look like? And they said, I include it in every orientation class. And I said, well, if you're trying to attract talent,
yeah,
aren't the people in orientation folks you've already selected? Like, how do you proactively tell the story to attract people?
Yeah.
And then sometimes, here's the other kicker I've learned, just again, another indirect finding around telling the story. And this is the sensitive issue, particularly here at Chick-fil-A, because I've got some operators. I had one operator tell me, said, no, you're wrong. He said, I got your three things. I'm doing that. And you're saying I got to tell the story. And he said, I tell the story everywhere I go. And I said, what story are you telling? And he said, I tell him about Truett Cathy and about selling Cokes out of a wagon. And I said, I love Truett like my own father, but that's not the story that's going to attract top talent.
That's right. Yeah, you got to tell your story. Yep.
Well, you got to tell better boss, brighter future, bigger vision, that story.
Yeah, yeah.
That story, that's what's going to attract him. I said, now, take the Truett story, and there's a lot of value, and there's a lot of legacy, and there's a lot of history, and put that in orientation.
Right.
But when you're going out and talking to that youth group, and you're trying to attract young people, you got to talk about better boss, and what that means to you, and your plans to lead them well, and to help them grow as a leader if they choose to. The brighter future and the bigger vision and what you're about and what your restaurant's about.
Hmm.
So I know in some circles that's kind of touchy. So are you saying we shouldn't talk about Truett? I said, no, that's not what I'm saying at all. But remember, this is a future-oriented person. And if you think about what you're doing, you're actually telling them a story that happened almost 100 years ago
Yeah.
From about a person they've never met or never heard of.
Yeah. 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 You're dead right about that. You know, what we noticed too is that what we've found has been one of the most successful things that we've done in our recruiting. And we didn't do it for this reason. We started on our social media of recognizing people that were leaving our organization for bigger and better things in their field. So we just last week had a marketing director that had been with us for probably 7 years, all through high school and college, who graduated, got her degree in event management, and had just gotten a job with a really prestigious hotel firm, you know, in our area. And we were just thanking her for being such a great part of our team. And yet it was one of our most liked, you know, posts. And we've had actually people reference it when they come and take or hand in an application. They're actually referencing and saying, why, I love a company that helps and is okay with people leaving on to bigger and better things. So I think it kind of goes back to what you're saying. In a way, without meaning to, we were showing that there's this growth, and not only here, but there's a growth going forward too.
Well, and I am not surprised. I need to be sure and clarify for your listeners. We, in the midst of all of our research, we visited about 45 or 50 Chick-fil-A restaurants that had an outstanding reputation for amazing people. And your listeners need to know, Rocky, that I sat in your dining room with you and your people. So I'm not surprised at all that you would do that. That's how you get such great people.
Thank you. We these are things, Mark, that, you know, the reason why I wanted you to come on is that you've had a tremendous impact on Chick-fil-A, but not only Chick-fil-A, now you get to have an impact on business as a whole. But in my personal story, you started teaching and preaching this high performance leadership model. You started teaching years before I felt the crunch that I had better change or else it was going to start hurting. And so I think you kind of really helped the learning curve for me. And so I appreciate it. I don't think it would have been possible for me to be the leader I am today if it wasn't for people like you who had the vision to see it before it was really happening within Chick-fil-A.
Well, thanks for that. Let's just keep learning together. How about that?
That's exactly right.
I've got to jump in here, Mark.
Yeah, Larry's got a question about the story he wants to know.
What happened to the hotel owner?
What happened to the hotel owner? I think he realized, and for those in the audience that don't know, there is a character in Talent Magnet who, let's just call him a naysayer of this whole idea of top talent.
Mm-hmm.
He just hadn't bought the vision.
Yep.
Or hadn't caught the vision, I should say. And what happened to him? People change for one of three reasons: vision, pain, or fear of future consequence. And sometimes it's a combination. And I think if you play that storyline out, it was a combination of pain and fear of future consequences. I don't think he went shifted his strategy because of vision, even though, you know, Blake was trying to cast a compelling vision. He was hurting. He was having trouble staffing his business with the caliber of people he needed to be successful. And I think he saw the handwriting on the wall. And so he made the shift that every successful talent magnet makes, and it starts with the leader's shift to believe that I can actually attract top talent. There's so many leaders that don't pursue this as a strategy because they think it's out of reach. Mm. You know, mm-hmm. It's like the high school kid that doesn't want to ask out the cheerleader because he believes that, you know, he's not in her league.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a lot of leaders in the world that are going, yeah, maybe Google, Amazon, they can pursue top talent, but I can't. Wow. And I just think that's just wrongheaded. And the hotel owner made that shift.
Wow. Yeah.
So he did make the shift, and he is growing.
Absolutely.
It's hypothetical, right?
Tell us, is there a favorite leader or somebody who really inspires you? And if not, maybe a life quote that you try to live by?
Well, let's go with that second question. A fun little story. I was doing a tweet chat. I don't know if you've done a tweet chat. I had never done one. For those listening that may not know what that is, it's basically like trying to have a conversation with the entire world at one time. And it was really giving me a headache. And the way it was structured is the host would give me a question and I would tweet a response out into the Twittersphere. And for about 5 minutes, people would react and respond. It would have a very brief, intense, succinct conversation all through Twitter about that question. And we'd do the next one and the next one and the next one. So we'd been doing this for almost an hour. My brain was about to explode. And the final question was, what's the best leadership advice you've ever received?
Okay.
And I was telling my mom this when she's in her 80s, and she said, well, at least you had 140 words, because she didn't quite get Twitter. And I said, no, Mom, that's 140 characters, but I was proud she knew that part.
That's right.
And she said, well, I bet that was really hard. And I said, it was. But it's the best leadership advice I ever received. Above all else, guard your heart.
That's fantastic.
For everything you do flows from it.
That's fantastic. Yeah. And I think we know where that comes from.
Yes, that comes from the book of Proverbs.
That's right.
King Solomon, the wisest man that ever lived. And I think it's the best advice I've ever received. And so I try to pass that on to leaders whenever I can. Because if your heart's not right, nobody cares about your skills.
Well, and that definitely fits in your theme of simplicity, too. That's a pretty easy thing to listen to and know that it's correct.
And hard to manage on a day-to-day basis.
Absolutely. So,
yeah.
Mark, talk to us about how we can contact you and where do we get your books or ask you to come speak at a conference. Kind of give us some information from you.
Okay. Well, my cell number is 678-612-8441. And text messaging works really well. The voicemail is almost always full, but the text messaging works great. And you can just call. If I'm not in the meeting, I'll take your call. That's probably the best way to reach me.
Okay.
I'm on Twitter at LeadersServe. I'm on Instagram at TMarkMiller, but most of that's family stuff. Although I'm thinking about expanding that. I'm seeing more and more people trying to use it as a platform for content. So,
yeah, yes, for sure.
I'm toying with that right now. But as far as getting the books, they're on Amazon, Barnes and Noble, and, you know, most bookstores you can find should have them. They may not have some of the older titles, but they're all still in print, and so available through Amazon.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us here on A Server's Journey. Remember to subscribe to the podcast and you'll hear more of what Rocky wants to share with you. To be good leaders, learning to lead by serving. If you like what you hear, well, tell a friend. Like us, share us on Facebook. Also, from time to time, Rocky has some great personal stories that he likes to share, and you can get them on the website, aserversjourney.com. So, Rocky, until next time, I'm your ever-faithful companion, Larry.
We are all on a journey, and it's really all about how you lead while on that journey. And that's why we're sharing this, A Server's Journey. I'm Rocky DeStefano. Thanks for joining with us, as together we learn to be better leaders.